With HelloFresh, you get farm-fresh, pre-portioned ingredients and seasonal recipes delivered right to your doorstep. Skip trips to the grocery store and count on HelloFresh to make home cooking easy, fun, and affordable. That's why it's America's number one meal kit. Is there a better time to enjoy a fresh-cooked meal than spring? So many ingredients are at the peak of their growing seasons, and flavors in full bloom at HelloFresh. Enjoy the taste of spring with chef-crafted recipes featuring ripe seasonal ingredients delivered right to your door. And there's no more scouring the grocery store for that one ingredient you need to complete your recipe, something I know a whole lot about. HelloFresh takes away all that hassle by delivering fresh, pre-portioned ingredients so you have exactly what you need, and it helps you cut down on food waste. And HelloFresh cares about quality. That's why their seasonal ingredients are picked at peak ripeness and travel from farm to your home in less than 7 days, so you know that they're fresh. As I've told you on the podcast before, I am not a great cook. My wife, my oldest daughter, they can stare into the fridge, see a couple of ingredients, add some spices, and boom, we have a great meal. Me, I need a plan. HelloFresh gives me that plan. They make it easy, that's so easy that I can cook a great dinner. So if you want to join HelloFresh, go to HelloFresh.com/16BA2023. That's code 1616BA2023 for 16 free meals plus free shipping. That's HelloFresh.com/16BA2023. And remember, HelloFresh is America's number one meal kit. You can join the club today. Get HelloFresh.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me is Peter Flaherty. Millie is asleep. We are in the busiest time of the year. This is the week leading up to regionals as we record this. It's Wednesday, May 31. Regionals are like less than 48 hours away already. So by the time you're listening to this, it'll definitely be upon you. The eve of the NCAA tournament, a very exciting time of year. We finally have an official NCAA tournament bracket. We're not talking about what teams could get in, how they get in, you know, none of that. It's just they're in. We can break down bracket. We can break down how the bracket was created. There's a ton of stuff happening. The transfer portal opened officially yesterday on Tuesday. There's a, for the first time, we've got a window and the amount of time that all the players have to get in the portal by the end of the season. So that started on Tuesday. So that's happening. And then, of course, this is the busiest time of the year for coaching changes as hirings and firings are being made. Just within the last week, both Georgia and Missouri have fired their coaches, leaving the SEC with 3 job openings. There are a lot of openings around the country. I think we're north of 20 already in terms of the changes that are getting made. So, Peter, very busy time of the year, but it's a great time for college baseball, especially as we look ahead to the NCAA tournament this weekend.
So you summed it up perfectly. It is the best time of year. It is also the busiest time of year. And there's something going on for really any college baseball fan, whether your team's in the tournament, competing for a national championship, whether your team is out of the tournament, potentially making a coaching change, or even just monitoring the transfer portal for guys that your team could pick up. So there's something for any fan out there. There is no doubt a ton of exciting baseball and great baseball to be played over the next 3.5-4 weeks. And it is really, you know, we talk about it even on the first episode of the podcast. It's a bit of a sprint to the finish. Now it is a whatever more than a sprint is to the finish, we're in it right now. So it'll be a lot of fun over the next few weeks, and I'm excited to see how it all unfolds.
We are going to set the transactions aside for now. We'll catch up on those at a later date. The breaking down the regional bracket is the primary purpose of what we're doing here today. We're not going to go region by region. If you've listened to me do this podcast over the years, you'll know that I really don't like that. It ends up being a little monotonous, and we start off, you know, really strong, and by regional number 12 we're clearly fighting it. And so for the sake of the listeners and ourselves, we're not going to do it that way. We're going to talk through the bracket in a few different ways, however. But first, Peter, I guess we should address how the bracket was created on Selection Monday. Well, I guess on Sunday when they released the host sites, We got a little bit of a, not a surprise, I guess I shouldn't say, but it was, I know both of us were disappointed by the host site announcement. I wasn't surprised by the 16 teams that were selected as hosts. If you read my projections on Sunday morning, 15 of those 16 were teams that I projected. The one that was not, I had Boston College in and South Carolina out. And I'll be honest, I was probably just trying to manifest a Boston regional at that point. The writing was relatively apparent that South Carolina was probably going to host. And I'm not here to say that they don't deserve it or anything. I mean, I've said my piece before about why there should have been a regional in the Northeast, and BC finished with plenty of numbers that back up the fact that they had at that point earned a regional. I view it as a big missed opportunity to have put a regional in the Northeast for the first time in more than a decade and on campus in the Northeast for the first time in like 30 years or something. So missed opportunity there, but that all got dwarfed by what happened on Selection Monday itself. We did get some surprises there as Oklahoma, Louisiana Lafayette, and Arizona all made the field. That was to varying degrees of surprise. I had the Cajuns in and Oklahoma and Arizona out. Those teams being in meant teams like USC, Kansas State, UC Irvine, Kent State, Notre Dame, like those teams got left out. I felt the worst for UC Irvine. They went like 8-1 against the Pac-12. A couple of those Pac-12 teams dropped out of the top 50 in RPI just in the last 2 weeks of the season. So then when you're looking at their top 50 record, it looks like they've only played one top 50 team, but they played like 8 top 60 games. Arbitrary endpoints, definitely doing a lot of work there against the Anteaters. So that was disappointing. But, you know, ultimately, like we can sit here and argue about the last couple of teams in the field. But for the most part, you know, I think this was a fine field. It was understandable. Selection committee chairman John Cohen said that he thinks that it's time to, you know, take a long look at RPI and explore revamping or completely scrapping the metric in favor of something else. I wrote about that. You can read it at baseballamerica.com. It's probably time for all of that. But Peter, what did you think about the selections, the hosts, the at-large teams, the whatever part of the selections?
Yeah. So first, I think I'm with you in the only host or lack of host that I was surprised with was Boston College, because we had talked about it at length last week on the podcast. And honestly, it was a kind of a BC versus Alabama debate, which is ironic because Alabama ended up being the 16th overall seed, so technically the last host, if you want to phrase it like that. And we were going back and forth on the two teams, and Alabama's RPI ultimately it skyrocketed to a point where if you take their RPI of 11, the 40 overall wins, it was darn near impossible to leave them out of a hosting spot. And with BC, and kind of when looking towards when could we see an on-campus regional in the Northeast, I don't know what more BC could have done. I guess the simple answer is, well, they should have won more games, but they're sitting there with an RPI of 18, 35-18 overall, 16 conference wins, really good quality wins too, and they still don't host. So I think that's as good a chance as we're going to see at a Northeast regional in who knows how long. But like you said, overall, nothing too shocking. I'm with you, and I felt the most bad for UC Irvine because, like you said, they had swept Arizona State. They have two wins over USC. They beat a ranked UCLA 12-4. And so that's 6 or 7 wins that are right on the cusp of top 50, being RPI top 50 wins. So I probably felt the worst for them. I was a little surprised with Arizona. I know that they've been playing great, and they looked really good in the Pac-12 tournament, and they were right on the cusp of a Pac-12 title. And there's something to be said for that, but I don't think that recency bias should necessarily erase or negate the rest of the team's resume or lack thereof. I know their RPI ended up working their way into the top 45, and looking at it from 10,000 feet, it wasn't all that bad, but you kind of look at them against an Arizona State, and Arizona State has that series win. And I know with they had a random midweek game that didn't count towards the conference schedule where U of A took it to them and won 20-0. But I think that I probably feel the worst for UCI. USC, it would have been outstanding if they had gotten in. I think that this was the start of what I hope and think is going to be a really good era of USC baseball with Coach Stankiewicz at the helm. I think that this is just the tip of the iceberg of what they're capable of. So it stung a little bit, but they are so incredibly ahead of schedule with what they're doing. There's no doubt that they'll be in the regional mix, and who knows how high they'll be able to work themselves in the near future. But overall, the biggest takeaway was, I think and it's such a slippery slope because John Cohen recognized the flaws in RPI, and I agree with him. But as you had said on Twitter, and I give you credit for giving basically the same reply to anyone who asks, yes, the RPI is flawed. Yes, it needs to be changed, but it's not going to change now. Like, this is what they're working with now. Like, this is something to change going forward. And hopefully they place more of an emphasis on the ELO ranking, which is a better, I think, snapshot of the overall makings of a team. But nonetheless, I think it kind of went as planned. And then, and Kyle Peterson does a great job on ESPN. I thought he made a great point that summed up the RPI and what it's about. And I could be paraphrasing it, but it was kind of like, it's time to stop rewarding teams for trying. And I thought it was interesting because while it's admirable that some teams will schedule a really hard front end of the schedule or a really hard non-conference schedule to kind of have this RPI cushion when we get down to it, you got to win those games. Like, I think that, again, it's great that you're playing these tough teams, but there's something to be said if you're not beating these tough teams. So really no like insane gripes with the field. I'm beating a dead horse, but I do think UCI should have gotten in. I think K-State also had a good case. It'll be a good tournament, and I'm excited to see how the committee kind of reworks their, I guess, logic going forward.
Yeah, so I don't want to get too deep into the RPI formula and all the rest of it. It ends up being really wonky and it's difficult to talk about, let alone write about. But what I found interesting as I was researching some of RPI related things on Monday, as I realized that that was what I was going to have to write about, they changed the RPI formula about 10 years ago, and they made road wins be worth more. That was the basic change. And at the time, they noted, I found all of this in an Inside Pitch magazine article, which is the ABCA's like official magazine, the Organization of American Baseball Coaches. They noted that at the time they were changing this, the basketball formula gave road wins even more credit than the new baseball one was going to give credit. And according to the article I read, like, they said that the baseball people didn't want to go as far as basketball did because baseball was a game that was played outdoors, which is, I don't really understand what the point of that was, but that it was a game, or it was a season of series, that it wasn't just you play one time, you play three times. And I found that to be very interesting. Then when I talked with coaches who are not happy that right now, basically you can be rewarded pretty heavily for not playing very many road games. If you look at strength of schedule, non-conference strength of schedule, even Arkansas rates absurdly high considering that it played one road non-conference game. And I'm not here to like call out Arkansas for having a bad having gamed RPI. I don't care about any of the teams that gamed RPI. Like, I would, if I was a coach, I would have scheduled like Mitch Hanna's, like Dave Van Horn, like pick a team with an amazing RPI. Like, those guys are doing a good job scheduling to help their teams get where they need to be this time of year. But clearly something within the formula is not working. And it's a number of things that are not working, because you can, I don't like the term, but you can game RPI in a number of ways. You can game it by sitting at home and playing a bunch of teams you know you can beat. And, you know, if your whole conference does that, you're going to end up with a high RPI because you're all going to feed off of each other. Or you can hit the road, play a bunch of teams that you're not going to beat, but that you know are going to end up with impressive RPIs at the end of the year, and, you know, feed off of their RPI. And like teams do this literally every year. This year it ended up being more of a flashpoint because the SEC had 9 teams in the top 20 or whatever it is. And there were a couple mid-major teams that got squeezed out of hosting. And of course, if you look at it, you understand why this became more of a flashpoint. And I hope that this flashpoint becomes the impetus for change, because people in the sport are not happy about the RPI formula. That's true. That's been true for years, but it does seem like there's actual, if the committee chairman, who is also an SEC AD and has a lot of juice in the college baseball world, if he goes on TV on the selection show and says, I want to fix RPI, like, that you cannot have like a stronger statement than that. So hopefully they act on that. Hopefully that's not just lip service. Hopefully they are able to do some of the things to go in and correct the metric, because I think that it absolutely has to be fixed. I think that you can talk around any number of reforms for the selection process and how they should emphasize this thing or that thing or the other thing. The problem is RPI is the basis for just about everything. And, you know, so if they go and they talk about like, well, you know, you didn't play enough top 50 games, or like, oh, Indiana State, you're 2-9 against top 50 teams. Well, that all just goes back to RPI. So if you don't have RPI fixed, you know, like, okay, Irvine played one top 50 opponent. Well, you don't fix RPI. That's not, you can talk about top 50 wins. You can talk about top 25 wins, top 100 wins, you know, whatever. If you don't fix RPI, you're not fixing that aspect of it. So there needs to be reform or a completely new metric. Basketball created an entirely new metric for itself. They had a lot of advantages in doing so. So maybe, I don't know how realistic it is for baseball to whole cloth a new metric, but it at least needs to be examined. And the sooner the better at this point.
Yeah, and you make a great point with RPI being the basis of everything, because I think that while it's easy to be pretty reactionary about RPI needs to be fixed, there needs to be a better metric. Well, yes, it's also not as easy as that, because as you said, everything that gets referred to and everything that gets talked about on a team's resume, it's built around RPI. So I'm also with you that there's really no stronger endorsement than the chair going on TV and saying it needs to be fixed. So it'll be interesting to see how it all unfolds for 2024 and beyond.
One last question, Peter, before we move on to analyzing the field as opposed to the creation thereof. So I spend all spring trying to project what I think the committee will do. And as a result, I think that that sometimes warps my judgment on what the field should and not will look like. Cause I don't always have the judgment of thinking, or the opportunity to think about what I think it should look like. It's what I think they're going to do, not what I want. So my question to you, someone who doesn't spend, you know, several hours a week trying to project the committee's moves, is, do you think the tournament should they be trying to select the teams who had the best season, February to May? Or do you think they should be putting kind of the best teams in the field? And I guess what I'm really asking by that is, does a team like Arizona, which is hot right now, can probably make a run, do you want a team like that carved out into the field? Because peak Arizona, what we've seen out of them is really good. I see a lot of similarities between Arizona and Ole Miss in terms of resumes. I'm not saying the Cats are going to go win the national title. Both teams were under 500 in their leagues. They both have like real offensive firepower. At their peak, they're very good, but they also bottomed out at times during the season, and that hurts their overall numbers. That's why Arizona's 12-18. That's why Ole Miss was under 500 last year in the SEC, but they got it together late. They're playing really well right now, and they're going to be a problem in a regional potentially. I mean, we saw Ole Miss go all the way. Like, do you think a team like that should get in? Or even if their overall numbers are a little bit lacking because they had, in Arizona's case, like 3 or 4 weeks where they couldn't win a game?
So I'm in the camp, and this one is easier said than done. My overarching thought is you put the 64 best teams in the tournament. Now, how you determine that I guess is up to the committee. I think there's a lot to be said for the eye test with this. And then also, I think a useful metric going forward is going to be the ELO. But anyways, I'm in the camp of you take the 64 best teams in the country. Do I think that there are 63 better teams in the country than Arizona? No, I don't. And I also don't think there are 63 teams better than Kent State, UC Irvine, and USC, and Kansas State for that matter. So I think it also goes to speak, I guess, for the flaws of RPI a little bit, but I think you just take the 64 best and put them in. And now with Arizona, in that logic, it is a very interesting case, because I had mentioned earlier, I don't think a hot few weeks should negate kind of the rest of the year. But I do think that there's something to be said about them playing their best baseball in May. I do think that they should be rewarded for kind of this hot stretch and going to the Pac-12 championship and beating good teams along the way. So I think that they were completely, I think they warranted a bid, and I think they deserve to be in. But I don't know if you can kind of, like, I'm trying to word this correctly. If a lower seeded team in these conference tournaments makes a similar run to Arizona, I don't think it should be rewarded, you know, by almost like an auto bid to the field per se. So I think Arizona is a little bit of a different case where they're already playing good baseball, and then they supplemented that with a nice run in the Pac-12. So like if like a Louisville had gone to the ACC title game, I don't know if it should have been rewarded for that, but I guess long story short, I think you just take the 64 best and you put them in. And I think that we should look past what conference the team's in. We should look past kind of, I guess, the classifying a team as a mid-major school and all of that, which I know that is going to take a lot of time and might not ever happen. But again, I just go back, like, are there 63 teams better than Wofford? Are there 63 teams better than UC Irvine? Like, I personally don't think so. So it'll be hard to perfect this. It'll never be perfected because someone's always going to have a gripe. But I think that putting less and less of an emphasis on the RPI is going to clean up a lot of these, I guess, questions and potential controversies around who gets in the field.
Yeah, there is just a reality that, like, no matter what selection criteria you make, somebody is going to end up mad. And like that even happens in pro sports, which have like the most perfectly defined criteria you can ask for. Then some team in the NFC South goes 7-9 and you're like, wait, they get into the playoffs? Or you look at what's happening in the AL right now, where the entire American League East has a better record than the entire Central. I don't know if that's still true today, but like it's been true at various points over the last month. So yeah, it's supposed to be subjective, and people want it to be objective, and it just, like, that's just not, it's not where it's going to ever be, for better or worse. And I don't know that expansion, which you heard on the selection show, like, kind of thrown around, not like seriously, but just in a like, oh, like, this is why it should be expanded kind of way, you know, that just moves the place at which we're arguing about it. In general, I don't feel bad for major conference teams that get left out. I think every one of them can look in the mirror and say, like, well, could have done this differently. And like, it's true. But Arizona is a little bit of an inflection point for me, because they just put a 12-18 team into the tournament in conference play. And that had never even been done for the SEC. And I kind of think that they might have just set a precedent that people around college baseball are not going to be thrilled with in a couple of years, when some SEC team gets in at 12-18 and like several SEC teams get in at 12-18 or something like that, that might not work out real well for the rest of the country, I fear, by putting Arizona in this year. But, you know, we'll just have to wait and see on that. A lot can change. And one of the changes might be to RPI. So we'll see where all of this lands. No easy answers, as John Cohen said about reform and reforming the selection process. All right. So enough of that. We're going to get on to talking about the tournament, as games get underway here, what to look for, what teams are on upset alert, We're going to have you covered on all of that here in a second. But first, check this out.
If you know me, you know how much I hate making plans. But something I hate even more is having nothing to do. So enter Game Time. Game Time has made it so easy to look up events happening tonight in my area, and I can buy tickets the easy way. So maybe I'll head to a Nationals game, or I'll go see a concert or a comedy show, whatever. I get access to the best seats and the best deals at the last minute, all while keeping my plans stress-free, just how I like them. I mean, it's the fastest growing ticketing app in the country for a reason. Buy tickets in a matter of seconds, two taps and you're set. Tickets are sent directly to your phone so you never have to dig through all of those unread emails. Snag the tickets without the stress with Game Time. Download the Game Time app, create an account, and use code BASEBALLAMERICA for $20 off your first purchase. Terms apply. Again, create an account and redeem code BASEBALLAMERICA for $20 off. Download Game Time today. Last minute tickets, lowest price, guaranteed.
All right, Peter, let's dive in to this tournament. And I guess let's start with what we think is the most interesting regional. We've got 16 to choose from here. I think they are relatively even this year. Like I didn't see the field come out and think like, oh boy, what an easy regional draw that is for this host. I thought that they did a pretty good job at keeping them relatively easy. Or relatively even, you know, maybe a team in the first couple of seeds got an easier draw, but that's the way it should be, you would think. But anyway, most interesting regional. Where do you think you're going to spend most of your time watching this weekend?
I'm with you in that there isn't a regional out there where it's like, or a path to Omaha for that matter, where I'm sitting here and saying, oh man, this team, they've got a cakewalk, they'll coast to a super, they'll probably coast to Omaha. I think it's pretty evenly distributed. Each team kind of has a bump in the road or kind of a tough path, even number one overall seed Wake Forest in Florida. But the two regionals that I'm most intrigued by and the one that I'm probably going to be spending most of my time watching is going to be Stillwater with Oklahoma State, Dallas Baptist, Washington, and Oral Roberts. I think any four of those teams could win that regional, and I mean that sincerely. Washington was in the hosting conversation up until 2.5-3 weeks ago. Dallas Baptist, if they were potentially a conference championship away from hosting, I don't know or think it would have gotten it done, but again, a really good team nonetheless. Oral Roberts, they stormed through the Summit League. They're 2-0 against Oklahoma State, both in Stillwater this year. And then Oklahoma State, in and of itself, they went to the Big 12 Championship. They can really swing it. They can especially swing it in Stillwater. I think any team can swing it in Stillwater. So the ball's going to be flying. You're probably going to see a lot of wonky scores, a lot of double-digit games. And I think it's anyone's ballgame. We'll probably be talking about this more when we get to our four seeds that can make a run, if I'm foreshadowing there. But I'm going to be focused on Stillwater a lot. And then I also, in Columbia with South Carolina, that's going to be a tough one for the Gamecocks, especially I kind of have Campbell circled there for why it's going to be so tough for South Carolina, because Campbell, again, some people thought they should have been hosts. They were right there with their metrics. They're a really good club. They're an experienced club, and they always play with a chip on its shoulder. They always go in with that underdog mentality. Coach Hare does a magnificent job, and South Carolina I don't really even know how to describe it. They've really been playing poorly the last month and a half. They're kind of just, they've been in a perpetual downward spiral. They still got a host. NC State is interesting because of its offense and the ball flies at Founders Park. I don't know if the Wolfpack quite have the pitching depth to make it out of there, but I've got Campbell. I've got a potential Campbell over South Carolina upset there. And then looking elsewhere, like you said, every single regional is pretty, there are interesting storylines in almost all of them. And then I'll absolutely be honed in on Terre Haute as well, just because it's Indiana State's first time hosting a regional. They're a great story and also a really good team. And then you've got three other quality teams with North Carolina, who had an argument to be a two seed, I think. Iowa had a really good season in the Big Ten. They'll be without Keaton Anthony, but still, they've proven that they can win even without their best player. So they'll be a tough out for – that's going to be a really tough 2-3 game with Iowa and UNC. And then Wright State, they've been the kings of the Horizon League for quite some time now, and they've posed trouble in the past for some of these higher seeds. So those are kind of the three ones that I'll be mainly focused on, but I will certainly be doing my best to bounce around to all 16.
Yeah, so I think Terre Haute is really interesting for a lot of the reasons you laid out there. You know, I expect that to be a really fun atmosphere. It's not going to be the biggest crowd because it's not the biggest stadium, but I expect that the Sycamores fans are really going to turn out for that. And you get some really good pitching. Indiana State can pitch. North Carolina can pitch. Iowa can pitch. Like, I think that in an offensive weekend, like, it's going to be really offensive, but if around the country, but if you want to see some good pitching, I think Terre Haute is a great spot for it. I also really like the Columbia call. I think that's really interesting because you have South Carolina that's going to be facing a fair amount of pressure, I think, to do something in that regional. Fans in Columbia are, to say the least, a little antsy after the last month. You know, the season started so well. It hasn't gone so well as of late. And I think that, you know, there's going to be a fair amount of pressure on the Gamecocks to do something this weekend. Meanwhile, Campbell kind of always plays with a chip on their shoulder. That's kind of part of the identity of that program. And they're definitely going to be feeling it after not getting to host, you know, and getting sent down there. And NC State probably going to be feeling maybe like a little bit of house money, you know, after missing regionals last year, just to be back in that environment. So I think that one has potential. Clemson, you know, I don't love the full field necessarily in terms of storylines. Like, Lipscomb brings more to me from a storyline perspective if they're in Nashville versus being in Clemson. Lipscomb, of course, is in Nashville. And Charlotte, though, is coming in hot, having won the CUSA tournament. You've got Tennessee, which, you know, we've spent a fair amount of time on Tennessee. I think people can understand why that's an intriguing team. And then Clemson's, you know, I know Oral Roberts has a longer winning streak, but like, Clemson's the hottest team in the country. And they're trying to win a regional for the first time in more than a decade in Eric Backich's first season. So a lot of intrigue in that regional for me. And then I also just want to shout out Coral Gables, because from a history perspective, there's nowhere with more history. You've got Miami, you've got Texas, you've got Maine, you've got the Cajuns. Like, all of those teams have been to Omaha before. It's been a while for a team like Maine, sure, but it's a lot of baseball rich programs. And if you do get Miami and Texas on Saturday or on Sunday, I think that could be a really fun ball game.
And this one might be a really hot take, but you mentioned, or it's been a bit of a storyline, and it will be every year until some team breaks this, but the lack of success, I guess you could call it, for number one overall seeds is really interesting to watch. And the committee didn't do Wake Forest any favors with giving them Big Ten champ Maryland and Northeastern out of the CAA. Those are two really good teams. Northeastern is one that I especially have my eye on. They've beaten good teams all year. They've beaten Duke, they've beaten BC, and they've swept Indiana State. They can really pitch. They can really hit. Again, it's at the couch where the ball flies. And then Maryland is an extremely offensive team. They just pound the ball all over the yard. I think they're the first team since LSU in the late 90s to have back-to-back seasons of 100 or more home runs. I don't know if it's 100 or more, but they've put up really impressive power numbers. With the Terps, I don't know if they've quite got the depth on the mound to hold Wake, or to really contain Wake. I don't know if anyone in the field you can kind of be like, okay, they have the depth to hold Wake to however many runs a game or keep themselves in the game. But Northeastern, up and down that rotation in their bullpen, there are a lot of talented arms, and they have a team ERA of 3.5. On the other side of the ball, they all can really swing it, and it's just kind of your Northeast tough, gritty team. They're not going to kind of roll over for anyone. And if they can get past the Terps, and I assume that they'll be playing Wake Forest in that winner's game, that's going to be a really, really fun one.
Yeah, that's it is an intriguing regional to be sure, especially for a number one seed. Now, the thing about number one seeds is, yes, they have struggled over the last 20 years since this format has been created. They typically don't struggle in regionals, at least not lately. So we'll see if Wake can get out of this weekend unscathed. But really, it's been a super regional issue of late for the number one seeds. But Northeastern, like you said, they're tricky. Maryland is experienced and can swing the bats. So it's not necessarily going to be easy. The best thing Wake has going for it, beyond, you know, just being Wake Forest and being really good, is that they drew George Mason, which, you know, definitely one of the two or three worst four seeds in the tournament. No disrespect, but, you know, Mason is only there because they won the A-10 and they were not the best team or the second best team in the A-10 in the regular season. So we'll see what kind of fight they can put up, but it's not like Wake Forest has to deal with a high level four seed or a four seed with a true ace that they're going to be challenged by.
And I guess, I'm sorry to keep interjecting. Speaking of four seeds with a true ace, keep an eye on Nichols down there in Tuscaloosa. They've got Jacob Mayers, who he's been excellent for Nichols all year. He's a bona fide ace on Friday nights. Now it's going to be a really tough game to win and a tough regional to win, but don't expect the Tide to cruise necessarily to a game one win. He had a 1.93 ERA, 97 Ks and 70 innings pitched. So if you're looking for a four seed with a bona fide Friday ace, game one ace, whatever you want to call it, that's probably your best bet.
Yeah, let's just talk dangerous fours, because I think Nichols is a dangerous four. They already this season have a win in Alex Box Stadium. This weekend they're headed to Alabama. Like you said, they escaped Baton Rouge thanks to Tulane winning the AAC tournament and some little bracketing principles taking place there. And all of a sudden Nichols goes from Baton Rouge to Tuscaloosa and becomes Alabama's problem for the weekend. So they are tricky, and it's more than just Myers. I mean, he's a big part of it, but they've played really well this season under second year coach Mike Silva. It's been a long time since the Colonels have been in regionals, but now that they're there, I do think they're a legitimate problem. And you know, Alabama as the 16 seed should have a difficult regional. Like if you are the 16, like it should be hard for you. But I think that this Nichols team is a big part of why it is actually going to be hard for Alabama as the 16 seed this weekend.
Yeah, no, I agree. And then I think in sticking in Tuscaloosa, it doesn't stop with Nichols, because you've also got BC in there. And if you want to talk about teams that are going to be playing with a chip on its shoulder, I think BC is the perfect example. They're going to feel like they were disrespected by not being a host. They've got a lot of quality wins under their belt. And then again, three seed of Troy, who had a really good season out of the Sun Belt. There is no easy game for Alabama, no matter how you want to slice it. And like you said, the 16 seed shouldn't be rewarded with an easy regional per se. But the Tide they're going to have to work. Any team out of this regional is going to have to really work for a regional title. And especially Alabama as the host, if they want to advance to presumably Wake Forest, Winston-Salem, they're going to have three really good wins coming out of here if they want to win it. And then, yeah, no, that Myers, I assume that he'll start for him. That Myers game one game is going to be, that's going to be really intriguing.
No doubt about it. Other dangerous fours I like, Oral Roberts mentioned that they have a longer winning streak than Clemson. Even they've won 18 straight. They're going to Stillwater, a place that they're very familiar with. They play there every year. They swept Oklahoma State in a home-and-home midweek deal earlier this year. So they won in Obrate. They've beaten the Cowboys twice. They've got like 55 wins this year. It's not quite that many, but it's like that's a tough four. That's an RPI four. Like, I do kind of genuinely think that Oral Roberts probably should be a three, but it becomes Oklahoma State's problem, because I think that's a real challenge of a four team. And then we've talked about Penn on here before, which is a little unusual considering that it's the Ivy League champion. But we spent some time on them once they won the Ivy League, and we mentioned that they have some real pitching, starting with Dabrowski, and Auburn has much in the way that Nichols is going to challenge Alabama on Friday night, because they can throw a real pitcher at them. Auburn is going to face some real pitching from Penn. It's a relatively deep pitching staff too, so it's not just a one game thing for the Quakers. Like, they haven't been in a regional since 1995. It's the longest drought that got snapped in this year's field. But I think that they could make some noise. And even though they haven't been in the postseason in a long time, this is a team that this year played at South Carolina. And for the guys that were on last year's team, they played at A&M. So I don't think that the atmosphere there that they're going to see in Auburn is going to be overwhelming to them.
And like you met, Penn is a deep team on the mound. It starts with Dombrowski, the ace, on Friday. But Owen Cody's been really good. He's going to be at UVA next year. Brian Zeldin's another guy. He'll be pitching at Georgia next year. Carson Osmer and Eli Tropp out of the bullpen. I mean, they can really, really pitch it. And we saw it in their first series of the year at South Carolina. And keep in mind, this was a South Carolina team at 100%. And while they got swept, they lost 7-4, 1-0, and 6-5. So it was by no means easy for a really good South Carolina team at the time. And they kind of stormed through the Ivy League, no fuss, no muss, and they rolled their way through the Ivy League tournament. So I think that region in general is going to be pretty pitching centric when you look at Penn, and then also Southern Miss is a team built on its pitching, obviously. Tanner Hall has been magnificent. And then with Oral Roberts, wasn't part of the podcast agenda, but if we're picking a four seed to win a regional, I think that they're probably who I'm going to pick. Like you mentioned, they've swept Oklahoma State. They played Dallas Baptist tough outside of a stinker on Saturday. They've beaten Missouri State. They have the Summit League pitcher and player of the year on their roster. And it's an environment that they're going to be comfortable playing in. They've won there multiple times. They're not going to be intimidated, and I think that they match up really well with the teams in the regional. So I'd probably pick Oral Roberts coming out of there. It might be a little old takes exposed on that, because Oklahoma State, they could very well, as honestly any team in this regional could with Stillwater, but Oklahoma State could very well score 12 runs a game and kind of coast through this. But they're going to be a team I'm watching very closely, because I think for a four seed to have a shot, and really any team to have a shot, in a national championship, of course, but when looking at these underdogs in who's going to advance and who might be able to make some serious noise, I think a lot is going to come down to how they pitch against these good teams, because a lot aren't built to get in these shootout type games. They just can't go punch for punch with some of these offenses. So the teams that we'd hit on, Penn and Oral Roberts, especially, and then Nichols, they're going to, I think, cause a lot of fits. And then even Santa Clara in Fayetteville, just thinking out loud with the Broncos, they've got Blake Hammond and Nick Sando. They're going to be good arms abound in that regional. So it'll be very interesting, because I think that one of these four seeds they're going to pull off an upset.
If we're looking for four seeds that can pull off an upset, I'm just going to go straight homer right now and say Ball State. Ball State won the MAC in thrilling fashion over the weekend with a ninth inning grand slam to give them the lead over Kent State. They finish it off and then in the bottom of the ninth, closing it out. And they go back to Kentucky, where Ball State hasn't been in the NCAA tournament since 2006. The last time they made it, they got sent as a four seed to Kentucky, and they won the opening game against the Wildcats. And that was part of the reason why UK did not win the Lexington Regional that year, after winning, I believe they were SEC champions that year. And, this Ball State team doesn't have, you know, if you've paid attention to Ball State the last couple of years with the draft, I mean, you're aware that like Dre Jameson and Chance McDermott and Kyle Nichols, like they've had some really good arms come out of there. They don't have like a top three round arm this year. So it's not that kind of concern, but they pitch really well. They have a deep lineup. They're a solid team. And if you look at just open regionals, Lexington feels relatively open. Kentucky has not played that well of late. Now, obviously, playing SEC competition is a lot different, but like West Virginia 2 weeks ago looked like the best team in the Big 12, and they're there. And Indiana's there having won 40 games and just been a generally solid team all year. I think it's a relatively evenly matched regional. And if Ball State can pull the opening round upset, like who's to say that they can't keep the momentum going there?
Yeah, and one, Coach Maloney has done, I mean, one, he's an 80 grade person, and two, he's done an outstanding job. So they're an easy club to kind of pull for and happy to see them get in the field. And they are a really sound pitching staff, as you mentioned. The most prospect-y guy is probably Ryan Brown out of the bullpen. ERA is a tick high at 4.7, but he's striking out almost two hitters an inning. He's got what's been described as a Bugs Bunny changeup. Just command and control has been a little bit of a bugaboo. But outside of that, Trenor O'Donnell's been getting it done on Friday nights. Ty Johnson has taken a really big step forward this year, which has paid massive dividends. And then their lineup is pesky and they can swing it. And as you mentioned, that I think that Lexington Regional might be borderline along with maybe Terre Haute. But I think in Lexington, there's a legitimate case to be made that any of these four teams can advance. You look at West Virginia, the bottom fell out between the Texas series and the Big 12 tournament, but we're looking at a somewhat isolated sample size of five games. And obviously the recency bias is going to play into it, but they've been playing really well. They've had a really good team. Indiana, similarly, they had a great season in the Big 10 and their RPI is super high and they've got quality wins to their name. With Kentucky being the 12, I was a little surprised to see them so high. I think that was an RPI-driven seed with how high they were, with the Wildcats' RPI of 2 in the country. So, really, you know, we could get into any of these regionals, and I think that, you know, all of them have kind of really interesting wrinkles. But that one, I think, is the door is wide open for any of these teams to advance.
All right, we've talked about some good fours. We've talked about some open regionals. Peter, let's actually put some number one seeds on upset alert. Who do you think is in most danger as regional hosts of not winning their home regional this weekend?
We'll circle back a little bit to maybe 15, 20 minutes ago. The team that I think is in most danger is... I was down to 2 with this one, but I'm going to say South Carolina. I really think that Campbell is going to come out firing on all cylinders in this one. Like we mentioned, they play with a chip on their shoulder, their experience. They're not going to go in there afraid of the bright lights and kind of fold in this big environment. They'll honestly play up for it. And South Carolina has been in a bit of a tailspin. They're still not healthy. Noah Hall's out for the year. I think the Humps are getting them at a good time, and they can hit with them. And I think they borderline have the edge on the mound now too with how banged up the Gamecocks are. So I've got Campbell advancing out of Columbia.
Yeah, getting Cade Cooler back a week or two ago was a big deal for them going into this one. He pitched pretty well at the I guess it was 2 weeks ago he came back, and he pitched pretty well last week at the Big South tournament. So that's definitely a big one for Campbell. I definitely have to echo a South Carolina upset alert situation. I mean, they are not playing well coming into the tournament. They've lost 13 of 18. They've played well over the course of the season at Founders Park, but they've lost 13 of 18 games for a reason at this point. You know, I think I mentioned that maybe I didn't. I don't know. Anyway, the thing is, Alabama, the number 16 seed, has not won a regional since the selection committee began seeding all the hosts in 2018. Now, that's not the biggest sample size, but there's, you know, we talked about BC playing with a chip on their shoulder there. We talked about how Alabama's drawing a really tough four seed. Troy is capable of things there as a three seed. So I think those are two that you definitely have to be looking at. And let's get spicy, because like we can like cherry pick like South Carolina's like slide and backing into hosting a regional in some respects. And I can sit here and say, well, like the 16 seeds on upset. Of course they are. Like they're the 16 seed. So let's get spicy, Peter. And I'm going to say Arkansas is on upset alert, and they should not be. They are the number 3 overall seed. They're 30-4 this season at Baumwalker Stadium. However, you've got TCU coming in and they're hot. They've won 12 of their last 13. That includes winning the Big 12 tournament, sweeping through it last weekend. You've got Arizona, who we talked about how good their offense is, how hot they are having. They've won, what, 8 of their last 9. They finished as runners up, or 7 of their last 9 maybe, and finished as runners up in the Pac-12 tournament last weekend. I don't think Arkansas has a trouble, like they don't have a troubling 4 seed here, but just the fact that you have TCU, which is coming in having looked great down the stretch, and Arizona with that offense and the way they're playing, if you're looking for a top 8 seed that might get knocked off, and one of them probably will, you know, I think Arkansas got a really hard draw.
I agree with that one, and that's a great call, because you mentioned TCU and how hot they're playing. They kind of look like a little bit like a runaway train right now, and they're really feeling it heading into Fayetteville. And not only with TCU, Arizona similarly really hot, did lose in the Pac-12, and then Santa Clara, another conference champ. And then if we're going to go a little further and pick a top 8 national seed, I've got UVA on upset watch in Charlottesville, especially kind of when looking at ECU. 45-17, they didn't make it out of the American as conference champs, but they're a really strong club. They have experience. The one thing that's eluded them for however long is a trip to Omaha. I'm not going to go out and say the Pirates are going to make it to Omaha, but I mean, if they can make it out of Charlottesville, it's not the worst draw in the world with the Conway Regional, who they'd be matched up with Coastal Carolina, Duke, UNCW, and Rider. I think that there's as much of a path as there's been for the Pirates to make that elusive trip to Omaha. And then again with Army, I don't think that, you know, Army is going to make it out of here, but it by no means a cakewalk. And then Oklahoma last year, CWS finalist. You mentioned NC State playing with the house's money. I think that Oklahoma is going to have a similar mindset, one of the bubble teams that did get into the tournament. And they've been there before. There's a lot of turnover between last year's roster and this year's, but it's a coaching staff that knows what it takes to get it done. They push the right buttons in June. And that's, I think it's far from a cakewalk for the Cavaliers. And I think that ECU is going to be really, really hungry to kind of erase this narrative of they're a really good team in the regular season. They're a pesky team in regionals, but they'll kind of fizzle and not make it to Omaha. So I've got the Pirates there in knocking off the Hoos.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, obviously ECU knows what they're doing in terms of playing in the postseason. Those are familiar opponents. Virginia was in Greenville last year, and now ECU's in Charlottesville. They, those are two coaching staffs that know each other. They've played fall games against each other. They've played series over the years against each other. So there's a lot of familiarity. And then Oklahoma, you know, knows what they're doing in terms of playing on the road. Like, not only were they really good last season and, you know, they have experience playing in Omaha and all the rest of that, but for the players that were a part of that last year, they didn't play a home game throughout the tournament a season ago. So they're going to understand what they have to do going on the road in the postseason. So I like that call for Charlottesville as well. Let's round this thing out with let's talk about some players. And, you know, look, if you listen to this podcast, some of the players we mentioned, maybe you'll know them already, but we're not here to talk about how great Dylan Cruz is and Paul Skeens are here. Like, I want to talk about some players that are going to become bigger names this weekend. And so, you know, for me, and Peter, obviously, like, we know who these guys are. And if you're listening to the Baseball America College podcast, you might know them too. But I think these guys are going to become more famous. You know, nobody's a household name in college baseball. But like, in terms of households that care about college baseball, I think these guys are taking the next step towards that. And I mean, I'll just start, Peter. I'll say Bryce Arnold at Campbell. And really, you could say any number of Campbell players. But I'm gonna go with Bryce Arnold. That's just a feel thing over maybe a Lawson Harrell or something. But I think he could have a nice weekend in Columbia.
Yeah, you could name, like you said, any of these Campbell players. Really anyone in that lineup, particularly Conference Player of the Year Lawson Harrell, Bryce Arnold. Those are going to be two guys that, if Campbell plays as well as we think it's going to, and make some serious noise in this thing, it's going to be on the backs of those two hitters for sure. And then I'm also going to shift a little bit to the other side of the bracket. I'm going to go to Winston-Salem in Northeastern. I think that Mike Sirota, he's becoming a household name in draft circles, but I think just from an average college baseball fan standpoint, he might be a little bit of an unknown. He's got legit five-tool upside for the Huskies. He hit nearly 360 this year, 18 home runs, 19 stolen bases, 1-to-1 K-to-walk ratio. He's an outstanding defender in center field, good athlete, can really run. He's a guy with legitimate five-tool upside, and he's got a chance to be the highest draft pick in Northeastern history outside of Carlos Pena, who went 10th overall. He's going to be a really good guy and a really fun one to watch. And then going down to Coral Gables, shortstop Kyle DeBarge at Louisiana. He's from Baseball Factory Barb, which if those listening are unfamiliar, they really run the high school baseball scene down in Louisiana. They won the state championship again. He's a Barb product, really good defender up the middle, can swing it, got a really good feel to hit, feel for the barrel. So those are two guys that I'm watching. And then, and just kind of looking down further, Cameron Fisher at Charlotte has become a household name, I think. He's got 30 home runs, leads all of Division I.
Yeah, he was on my list. He went crazy in the Conference USA tournament last week to move into first place on the home run leaderboard. And he is a big reason why the Niners are in this tournament to begin with.
Yeah, so he's one too. There are really, you could kind of go up and down all these regionals, and all of these teams have really talented players on them. But those are the two or three, I guess, however many I mentioned. Those guys I'm really excited about.
Yeah, I think those are good calls. Sirota is definitely someone to keep your eye on if you're a draft guy. But just generally, like, he's the real deal there at Northeastern. I'm excited for more people to get to see what he's about. I would definitely echo that pick. You know, we mentioned Jacob Mayers. I think that is a huge name to watch for Nichols. If you're looking to tune into something like that, is whenever he takes the mound for Nichols, he currently is sixth in the nation in ERA. So definitely one to watch there. And then I got one more I wanted to call out here. Oh yeah, Jonah Cox at Oral Roberts has like a 40 game hitting streak or something stupid like that. That's somebody that wasn't even on my radar a month ago. But his numbers are insane. He has this ridiculous hitting streak. Oral Roberts is not playing premier competition in the Southland. It's true, or in the Summit League. It's true, but they're a really good team. Their players they've got some really good players, and Jonah Cox is one of those guys.
It's a great call with Jonah Cox, and they're kind of, in my mind, they can get the Campbell treatment. They have so many guys up and down that line.
Oh yeah,
and in the pit, like Cade Denton is going to be a guy that I think probably closes all, however many games that they play, however many wins they get. He won Pitcher of the Year. He's a legit draft guy. And then kind of going back to Coral Gables, it's, in talking this out, it's a really intriguing, I guess, mid-major regional, because looking at Maine, you've got Quinn McDaniel, the shortstop, who is probably going to go somewhere in the top 10 rounds of this year's draft. He's hitting 355, 16 home runs. He swiped 32 bases, and his walk to strikeout ratio is 60-42. And it's kind of crazy to think, but McDaniel has actually been striking out more lately to kind of, I guess if you could call it, like, ding this ratio. But elite bat to ball skills, can pick it up the middle. He's a fun player to watch. And then sticking with the Black Bears, first baseman Jeremiah Jenkins more than looks the part at 6'4", 240, 20 home runs on the year, drove in 75 runs, more walks than K's. It's as good of a main team as Coach Derba's had up there. And it's another kind of Northeast gritty team with the names to boot. So those are two more for your viewing pleasure down in Coral Gables. And then with Troy back up in Tuscaloosa, Shane Lewis at Troy has just been, he's been banging lately. Redshirt sophomore.
Third of the nation in home runs.
Yeah, he's up to 27 jacks on the year. Is going to be one of the more impressive power hitters in that region, along with Jenkins and Yo-Yo Morales. So another couple of fun ones in Coral Gables. And then I'm just kind of straining my brain. That kind of rounds out my list. Keep an eye on Blake Hammond at Santa Clara down in Fayetteville. He's been their ace. And yeah, I'm just kind of scrolling through here. Yeah, that rounds out who I've got.
Yeah, I just want to throw out Cam Cannarella at Clemson. And like, I know that he's a little bit of a bigger name because he plays for Clemson, but he's a freshman. And if you haven't been tuned, like, I've spent a lot more time talking about Caden Grice than Cam Cannarella because, you know, two way. And I do genuinely just, I've talked about Grice enough on this podcast. You know, you guys know my feelings if you've been listening, but Cannarella has been a revelation as a freshman. He's hitting 386. Like, he's a big part of why Clemson has been able to make this jump. So I think he's, there are some freshmen out there that are worth keeping an eye on that, like, even though they play for big time teams, I feel like haven't quite gotten the love of, say, like Ethan Petrie. I don't think I need to tell you guys about Ethan Petrie, but, you know, Ethan Petrie, Colby Shelton, Cam Cannarella, like, I think these are freshmen that if you're not aware of them right now because they are still new to the college baseball world, like, they have the ability to do something this weekend to kind of raise the awareness level.
And if we want to stay on the one, those are great calls. Cannarella was a guy that I've been blown away with all year, even more so in the ACC tournament. Outstanding feel for the barrel. Great defender out in center field. He's hit his way to the top of the Clemson lineup. He's just a dude in every sense of the word, just an electrifying player to watch. And in sticking with freshmen, Nolan Schubart at Oklahoma State, 6'5 Adonis, Big 12 freshman of the year, hit 343 with 20 doubles and 16 home runs.
Super clutch. I don't know how he constantly, I feel like, comes up in the ninth inning.
Oh, I was going to say he's got the knack for a big hit, and he's got probably, I'd say, 70 raw power. And he's another freshman who I think is going to be a key contributor for his team in this tournament. And then one of your guys, actually, I wouldn't go as far to call him as a cheese ball for you, but in Florida, you talk about the Jack Cagliones and Wyatt Lankford's of that lineup, but Cade Kurland is a guy that I think would be getting a lot of love if he wasn't necessarily overshadowed by those guys. He hit really well in the SEC as a true freshman, everyday member of a really good lineup. And he's been excellent for the Gators.
Yeah, absolutely. And within the BA Slack, clearly I didn't realize that my takes were so hot on Cade Kurland, but yeah, I guess he at least by our internal metrics, I am the high man on Cade Kurland. So, I think you're right. Like, if Wyatt Lankford and Cags and whoever else, you know, Rivera, BT Riopel weren't there, like, I think people would spend more time realizing that the Cade Kurland was a huge piece of that. But as a member of that lineup, a big part of it for sure, and a name worth knowing over the next couple of years. I got one more, and then we can quit naming some guys. But that's James Talon at Duke. If Duke's going to do anything, you know it's going to come from their bullpen. So why not the guy that has 11 saves make a big impact this weekend in Conway? I think that's entirely on the table for the Blue Devils.
He's one, agree on Duke's bullpen. It's him and O'Shelbeck. They're left-hander and right-hander respectively, each up into the upper 90s with their fastballs with a plus off-speed offering. And then if we're going to name most fun or exciting player to watch, head on down to the Nashville Regional. You've got Enrique Bradfield on Vanderbilt, who's great, 80 defender, 80 speed, plays the game really hard. But my most exciting player is going to be Riku Nishida at Oregon. Hit 313 this year, stole 23 bases. Actually had a little bit of thump in his bat with 20 total extra base hits, 14 of them being doubles. Can really run, defends exceptionally well in the dirt, but they've also used him in the outfield. And to kind of add to his allure, I don't want to say he's the only one who does this, but he has to be one of the only people in college that swings a wood bat exclusively. So
is he still doing that though?
He is. Really? I heard the crack of the, I think it's a Marucci that he swings. I heard it on ESPN during the Pac-12 title game. So just an exceptionally fun player. It's, his energy is infectious. It rubs off. So he's in much watch, must stream territory for me as well. And I promise I'm done after that.
No, he is a really fun one for sure. So a lot of really talented players. Hopefully we can discover even more. That's the great thing about this weekend, is that players pop, they go off, and they have big moments, and you can learn about some new guys, whether they're new to you or just, you know, some players, you know, just have big moments, and you know, this is the brightest stage of their career, and you know, we won't really hear about them again, but they come through. You know, you think about like Carson Finvold for Florida. I guess that was last year, maybe 2 years ago, just like came through with a massive start in the postseason, kind of out of nowhere. You know, like, I love that part of the tournament, that you can have players do that. So I'm excited to see who pops across the country this weekend. That's going to do it for us today on the podcast. We have plenty to read previewing the NCAA tournament over at baseballamerica.com. So I'd encourage you to check that out. You can follow us on Twitter throughout the weekend. I'm at Ted Cahill. Peter's at Peter G. Flaherty. I will be between Clemson and Columbia, probably mostly at Clemson, but going to be at Columbia a little bit as well. Peter's going to be tracking everything around the country. So I'm sure he'll have some great highlights and everything over on his feed. We'll be back here next week with another edition of the Baseball America College Podcast to get ready for Super Regionals and wrap up the regional round. So make sure you're subscribed to the Baseball America Podcast on your favorite podcasting app, be that Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us, follow, rate, review. You know the deal at this point. We're near the end of the season. You've heard me say that plenty of times. So go ahead and do that. As we get ready for a great postseason run, we're going to have a lot to cover over the next month. Peter and I are excited about it. I'm sure you're excited about it. So let's just get to these games. I'm tired of talking about them. So with that, for Peter, I'm Teddy. We'll talk to you next time.